It's aspen, bark, or top, 15 minutes for each side.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Jack Tanner. I'm with Fairfield and Woods. I'm here on behalf of Arthur Beer. On October 1st, 2003, a man named Dennis Barker was summoned to the offices of his lawyers. Mr. Barker was engaged in litigation with his landlord. Mr. Barker's lawyers told him they had lost. His landlord had a judgment against him, and his landlord was going to seize a patent that Mr. Barker had for an invention he had made. The invention was an automatic opener for a Jeep soft top. So Mr. Barker, on the advice of his lawyers, transferred that patent to a company called Aspen Barker Top, ABT, that very same day, October 1st, 2003. Now on October 1st, 2003, my client, Arthur Beer, was a creditor of Mr. Barker. Therefore, under the law, that transfer was void as to my client. Despite that, my client's claims against Aspen Barker Top were dismissed on summary judgment. And the main issue I want to talk about today is trying to get that summary judgment reversed to go back to the trial on the merits. There were three claims asserted. The first was unjust enrichment. Unjust enrichment is an unusual claim because it doesn't require actually any wrongdoing by the defendant. The classic unjust enrichment case is the man who owns an orchard and spends all this time growing an orchard, and just before the crop comes in, a windstorm blows his crop onto his neighbor's land. He can sue the neighbor for unjust enrichment, even though the neighbor's done nothing wrong except being downwind. Under a court of equity can say the downwind neighbor's been unjustly enriched at the expense of the orchard owner and order the crop be returned or payment made. So that was one of my claims on behalf of Mr. Beer against ABT, that transfer had been fraudulent and should not be recognized, and that claim was dismissed on summary judgment. The other two claims, in case the court is looking for actual wrongdoing, unlike an unjust enrichment claim, and were for fraudulent transfer and for aiding and abetting. Under the Colorado Fraudulent Transfer Act, a transfer that's fraudulent as to one creditor is void as against all creditors, known or unknown, present or future. It doesn't matter. If your transfer is expressly intended to defraud a creditor, then it's void as against all creditors. Again, my client, both on the date of this transfer and today as a judgment creditor with a judgment in excess of $250,000, is a creditor of Mr. Barker. But my client's been able to collect nothing because the only asset Mr. Barker had of value was transferred in this fraudulent conveyance to Aspen Barker Top. Under the Colorado Fraudulent Transfer Act, that transfer should be void. It doesn't matter that it was made with an intent to defraud a different creditor. It covers all creditors, including my client. That law of Colorado has been well settled for decades and decades. The seminal case of Fish against East from 1940, it's a Tenth Circuit case, but it applies Colorado law. That case specifically says under Colorado law that it doesn't matter that the conveyance was intended to defraud a different creditor, in this case the landlord. It was still intended to defraud a creditor, therefore it's void against all creditors. My client is now a judgment creditor, again, of Mr. Barker, and therefore he should be allowed to avoid that transfer and get at the patents to satisfy his judgment. Because of the summary judgment ruling that was entered, my client's not been allowed to have his day in court on those issues. The primary defense as offered by ABT to the fraudulent transfer claims were, first of all, this issue of we weren't even unaware Mr. Beer was a creditor at the time. But again, under the transfer law, the fraudulent transfer law, that's not a valid defense. If the transfer is void, it's voided against all creditors. Secondly, they've claimed that Aspen Barker Top, ABT, was a bona fide transferee of the patent. But that is not right either, and certainly not something that could have been resolved by the trial court on summary judgment. The evidence before the trial court, both from the August of 2005 hearing and then later at the trial itself, although the trial occurred after summary judgment was entered, the evidence at the hearing and also supported the affidavits by affidavit was that the principals of ABT were the two lawyers and Mr. Barker. They were the owners, they were the management, they were the people that were in on the scheme to defraud. Therefore, their knowledge that the transfer was fraudulent is imputed to ABT. ABT cannot have been a bona fide recipient of that patent when its founders, its management, and its owners all knew that the transfer was a fraud. They were in on the fraud. One of them came up with the scheme to defraud. And that was the primary defense to the summary judgment motion. Now, we don't know what Judge Mullins was thinking when he granted summary judgment. He stamped granted on the motion, and that was his order. And at trial, you'll see in the transcript, he openly questioned why he had granted summary judgment. He asked me, he asked Mr. Graham, who was Mr. Barker's attorney, what was I doing granting summary judgment? And we couldn't help him. We don't know. But Judge Mullins clearly said he couldn't remember why he granted summary judgment in this case, and it should not have been granted. The case authority in our brief, again, is the BMS partnership against Winter Park Devil's Thumb Investment Company and the Bach against American Growth Fund sponsors case. Both those cases are cases that show that knowledge of the management or owners of a company is imputed to the company for purposes of a good faith analysis. And in this case, you just can't decide as a matter of summary judgment that ABT acted in good faith when it received a patent pursuant to a scheme to defraud creditors.
Now, you are relying simply on the debt as opposed to any right to the patent itself?
Correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
And the debt you would describe as what?
Well, now it's been reduced to judgment. That was the trial we had. It's in excess of $250,000. It was for theft. It was for fraud. It was for conversion. I think there were six claims, and we won on all of them. The judge ruled in our favor.
Was Beer a creditor at the time of the transfer?
Yes, he was. Although, again, under the Uniform Transfer Act, that doesn't matter. It applies to future creditors as well. But, and this is the ironic part, or maybe interesting part, if you'd ask him on that day, October 1, 2003, if he was a creditor of Dennis Barker, he would have said no. He thought he'd invested in a legitimate company, Barker Top Inc., BTI, and that BTI had the patent. And if you'd ask him at that time, are you a creditor, he would have said no. It was only later, when this fraud was discovered and unwound, that he found out he, in fact, was a creditor of Mr. Barker, because Mr. Barker had never transferred the patent to the company my client had invested in, as he had promised my client he would do. That's why he got securities fraud was another thing we prevailed on against Mr. Barker, for securities fraud, because that's what he did. He told my client the patent is going into a company. My client invested in that company, but the patent was never transferred to the company. Mr. Barker kept the patent in his own name until October 1, 2003, when he transferred it to a completely different company as a hindrance to his landlord creditor.
Is there also a loan that was still outstanding at that time?
Yes, there was. And again, my client, the transaction between my client and Mr. Barker was not papered as clearly as it could have been. I'll say I wasn't involved at the time, but there was some money that was transferred. Some was a loan, some was investment. The documents did not necessarily make it clear what was what, and that was part of what the whole three-day trial was about, was to sort that out. But if you look in Judge Mullen's findings after the trial, he lays out what was a loan and what was investment, so it's in the findings. The other thing I wanted to talk about, the other major issue on appeal, is the discharge of the receiver, which was actually chronologically earlier in the case. We had tried to appeal that before. A panel headed by Judge Vogt had dismissed that as being premature, so we're back again on that. Again, because my client's understanding was he thought the patent at one point had been put into this other company, BTI, and stripped back out. So we thought we'll get a receiver appointed for that company to track down its assets, including this patent. That was the plan. It didn't work out that way, primarily because ABT completely stonewalled the receiver. The receiver did an investigation for nearly a year trying to get documents and records and was basically told no, 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 no. And then after some period of time, then it was Judge Meyer was the trial court judge at that time, just before he retired. He discharged the receiver. That order was premature, and worse, it left Mr. Beer hanging with all the costs of the receivership, which were greatly exacerbated by the conduct of ABT and his principals. And so we asked the court in equity at the end of the case to at least require them to pay some of the cost of the receiver. That was denied. I would just note that the trial court has authority to give that relief. A receivership is it's still an equitable device. It's probably the last bastion of real equity we have in Colorado. And a receivership court has jurisdiction to inherit a fair and equitable remedy under the circumstances. And in this case, I think the trial court abused its discretion in discharging the receiver and ordering the plaintiff to pay all the costs associated with it. I recognize common law says if you get a receiver appointed, there's insufficient funds to pay the receiver, the plaintiff ultimately bears the burden. I understand that's the law, and I'm not disagreeing with that proposition of law. But what I am disagreeing with is the court not exercising its equitable powers to say in this circumstance, we're at least going to make some of the cost of this receivership, which has been far more expensive than it should have been and far less expensive than it should have been because of the actions of the defendants. At least the defendant should bear some of the cost of that. So
did the court have jurisdiction or authority to assess those costs or attorney's fees against Mr. Wirtz or Mr. Feldman?
I believe we cited the cases
who are not parties to the litigation.
Well, that's a good question about them being parties. I understand that their names don't appear on the caption. But if you go to that August of 05 hearing, they clearly showed up and asked for relief. It's not clear what capacity they were in. They claimed to be there pro se on behalf of ABT, but ABT, of course, as an entity, can't appear pro se. It had to be by counsel. So I think the fact, again, under the rules of equity, the fact that they were present in the judge's courtroom and they asked the judge for relief, the judge had jurisdiction over them. And further, the judge had issued orders regarding turnover that were served upon them and were valid, and the court could issue some kind of sanctions in connection with the refusal to turn over. So yes, there's enough there for the court to have a jurisdiction to do that.
So that would be on the basis of sanctions rather than equitable relief?
You know, I confess I'm indifferent to the label we put on it. I think the court, whether the court calls it sanctions, the court calls it equitable relief, the court calls it
ask for sanctions,
whatever. We ask for that relief. We ask they be ordered to pay. And at one point, we certainly did ask for sanctions. And let me strike that. I think the receiver asked for sanctions. Of course, I'm representing the plaintiff. The receiver asked for sanctions. We kind of filed a brief explaining why sanctions should be awarded. But I think the prayer for relief was from the receiver. If I could, I'd save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may it please the court. My name is Jessica Yates, counsel for Appley ABT. I have with me today Michael Lindsay, the law firm Snell and Wilmer, and Alan Feldman, representative of ABT. I would like to start with the arguments about summary judgment, in particular, the fraudulent transfer claim. And there are several reasons why the district court correctly dismissed that claim. One, and the biggest reason, is that the claim was moot. The court had already determined that in its order denying the motion for turnover. That's because the relief that Mr. Beer requested under that claim was that the patent be transferred back to BTI. However, the district court concluded that the patent never belonged to BTI. Legal title had always been with Mr. Barker. If you void the transfer from Mr. Barker to ABT, the patent goes back to Mr. Barker. But in the district court, Mr. Beer was absolutely adamant that Mr. Barker should not have the patent or any of the property that he thought belonged to BTI. As a matter of fact, he moved for reconsideration of the termination of the receivership on that basis, and he complains about it on appeal. The idea that the district court would have left any of BTI's assets with Mr. Barker. There's a complete disconnect between the claim that he brought and the remedy he was seeking. And that moots his claim. And the district court correctly decided that in the order denying the motion for turnover. And that order has not been appealed here. It is law of the case.
The argument we just heard was not based on the right to the patent, but rather that Mr. Beer was a creditor, that he became a creditor later based on his judgment. And that the transfer at the time was intentional to avoid the landlord. And so that transfer was fraudulent with regard to Mr. Beer as well. What's your response to that? That's what I understand the argument to be.
I understand it that way as well. And there are a couple of responses. One is factual. And the presentation by the appellant was that the landlord avoidance was solid evidence. As a matter of fact, in the order denying the motion for turnover, the district court concluded that Mr. Barker was not credible on that basis. The district court said, I don't believe it. Here's why. You received 40%, the biggest share of the interest in ABT. You received additional investment dollars from additional investors. You received this great promotional platform. As a matter of fact, a mere month after this supposedly fraudulent conveyance in which supposedly Mr. Barker under duress handed his patent over to ABT, he went to Las Vegas with his new business partners to promote the patent, to market it. He was involved in meetings after meetings, enthusiastically participating. And the district court said, this isn't the story of someone who, under duress, all of a sudden one day was told he had to give his patent away to avoid a landlord. And it's important to note that that is reviewed under one of the most deferential standards of review. The trier of fact here was the court, listening to the facts, assessing credibility. At the trial between Mr. Barker and Mr. Beer, the court again found Mr. Barker to not be credible, a different judge in the district court nonetheless. And in that situation, Mr. Barker was saying, oh, well, the reason I didn't assign the patent to BTI, it was Mr. Wirtz and Mr. Feldman somehow interfered. And again, the district court said, that is not credible evidence. That kind of evidence, which is the evidence that is attempting to be used now to go back in time to reverse summary judgment, doesn't create an issue of fact for summary judgment, not on any of these claims. In fact, the trial between Mr. Barker and Mr. Beer was only between those two and their related entities. But ABT was not at the trial. They did not summon as witnesses Mr. Wirtz or Mr. Feldman or any representative from ABT. They weren't there to present their side of the story. They weren't there to cross-examine Mr. Barker on any of this. And therefore, none of the evidence at trial creates an issue of fact that disturbs the district court's summary judgment.
Ms. Yates, to be sure I understand correctly, first of all, with regard to the duress allegation, Mr. Barker was found to be not credible on that, and so we will defer to the trial court absent some evidence, so long as there is some evidence. But what about on the question of, regardless of duress, the intention was to defraud the landlord, that is to empty Mr. Barker's pockets so that he would be judgment-proof in the event that a creditor came after him?
Well, as I read the district court's order denying the motion for turnover, the district court also found that part of his testimony not credible. And therefore, it did not create an issue of fact in the mind of the district court for summary judgment. I would like to point out as well, there is this concern that's being relayed that the district court didn't fully explain why it granted its motion for summary judgment. There's actually, the court did comment in the trial proceedings that he believes that one of the reasons why he granted summary judgment was that Mr. Beer lacked standing. And a couple of occasions during the proceedings below, the court advised Mr. Beer to bring his claims derivatively as a shareholder of BTI rather than individually. Now, I recognize there's some inconsistency between that comment and the idea that maybe Mr. Beer was an individual creditor to Mr. Barker and that was a relationship that went outside of BTI, but that inconsistency certainly is not enough to go back in time and reverse the district court's ruling on summary judgment. I would also like to turn to the aiding and abetting claim and this thought that Mr. Beers brought us to a couple of different claims that somehow Mr. Barker's knowledge is imputed to ABT. Mr. Beer pleaded the aiding and abetting claim as aiding and abetting Mr. Barker's fraud. Well, the district court concluded that that fraud occurred in the year 2000 when Mr. Barker took Mr. Beer's money, promised Mr. Beer that he would assign the patent to BTI, and yet did not intend to do so at that time in 2000. That knowledge, that intent, those events do not reach forward in time 3 years to the time the ABT was created in 2003. And none of the cases cited by the appellant accomplished that result. In fact, that would lead to absurd results. It means that any time a corporation gained a member, that member's knowledge and actions and intentions and everything that member had ever done wrong would expose the corporation to new liability. And there's no case law to support that. In terms of the unjust enrichment claim, it's also worth noting that Mr. Beer acknowledged on page 29 of his opening brief that at summary judgment, he was relying on his pleadings and his operative complaint to survive summary judgment. And it's well-established civil procedure that that's not enough. For a motion to dismiss under Rule 12, yes, but not under Rule 56, which is where we were operating. And to resist summary judgment, he was required to provide evidence, affidavits, to counter the claim by ABT that the unjust enrichment claim should be dismissed. The reality is Mr. Beer had the wrong parties for the claim, and it goes a little bit to the standing question that the district court was concerned with. Mr. Barker was unjustly enriched, but at BTI's expense. BTI was the corporation that, is according to Mr. Beer, was supposed to have the patent, was supposed to be able to run with that patent and do all kinds of things with it. So if Mr. Beer had brought this claim derivatively, as he was invited to do so on several occasions by the district court, he might have had a chance, at least against Mr. Barker. There's another question, of course, whether this even stretches to ABT, because the events that were really unjust occurred in the year 2000. ABT wasn't created till 2003. And contrary to the arguments that are being made by appellant, Colorado courts do require wrongdoing to assess liability under an unjust enrichment theory. And a case example for that is Red Iron versus International Sales and Service Corp, 200 P3rd, 1133, and I'm happy to submit that in a supplemental authority letter. The upshot of it is that just because a corporation is at the tail end of a transaction that several years prior may have had some unjust originations does not make the benefit that the corporation receives somehow unjust. There are additional reasons, of course, why the district court could be affirmed on summary judgment. One of them is that Mr. Beer has already received a sizable compensatory and punitive judgment award against Mr. Barker and BTI. As a matter of fact, as part of that award, he has to pay back the cost of the receivership and the fees that are now being complained about on appeal. So remanding on that basis wouldn't lead anywhere. The appellant hasn't pointed to any specific category of damages that it thinks the ABT is solely responsible for. Instead, it's received its judgment for Mr. Barker, held to be a fraud. In addition, the district court on several occasions invited Mr. Beer to put the patent title at issue through a quiet title or a plevin action. Despite what's being claimed now through oral argument, the representations in the appeal brief is very clear that what the appellant has been seeking is title to the patent, not just money damages. But they failed to put that forward in a vehicle, a claim that would actually provide that kind of relief. They've waived their opportunity to do so. A few notes about the receivership and how that was handled. Of course, the trial court did not err in not requiring Mr. Wirtz and Mr. Feldman to pay the cost of the receivership because there was no trial court decision that could create error. The reason there was no decision is because the trial court was never asked to afford that relief. There was a passing footnote in a motion for extension of time that the receiver filed in the district court, making note that possibly that is something that the receiver would look into. But then when it came time for the receiver to request the relief to file the final report in the district court, that was totally absent from the relief requested. Mr. Beer joined in the final report again without asking for that relief. That's clearly waived. In addition, as this court has noticed, Mr. Beer nor Mr. Feldman were even defendants in the case. And these comments about breach of fiduciary duty and that they somehow made discovery difficult, well, those were decisions that were never presented to the district court to resolve, and so they can't be presented here. Discovery dispute without a decision by the trial court means that there was no trial court error for appeal. In addition, in terms of terminating the receivership, just to clarify the record, there is a lot of complaining in the appellate briefs that somehow the court erred in deciding to return BTI's assets to Mr. Barker personally. Of course, that's not what happened. The court returned the assets of BTI to the extent that there were any assets for Mr. Barker to hold for BTI. The court correctly found that there were no real assets of BTI that needed to be preserved, and it was a good exercise of the court's discretion. The patent couldn't be BTI's. There was no title claim to the patent that hadn't been actually resolved in any way that the court could find that BTI even had the patent. In terms of the two claims, a shareholder derivative action brought by Mr. Beer could have resolved those claims. Those were claims that supposedly BTI could bring against its lawyers or against Mr. Barker. Mr. Beer was invited to reconfigure the case as a derivative action, and he did not do so. And the bottom line is that in this light, the receivership was just expending resources without having any real utility, and therefore termination was well within the district court's authority. Would like to point out that we've asked for fees on the basis that, you know, A, there's at least one frivolous argument in this appeal, that being related to the cost of the receivership that was never raised on to the district court. The other reason for claiming fees is there's been some misrepresentations of the record. That's been truly regrettable in terms of what's happened, especially with regards to Mr. Wirtz and Mr. Feldman. Supposedly, according to the appellant, there was a breach of fiduciary duty. In fact, the district court was adamant in the record that it never had found a breach of fiduciary duty. The court put that in its order and its final report to the receiver. The disciplinary proceedings involving those two lawyers did not involve Mr. Beer, did not involve the patent, did not involve BTI. They simply were disciplined for going into business with their client without adequately disclosing the conflict. For those reasons, that's not a basis for exploring cost assessed against them or to somehow revive the receivership. A few points that I would like to make just to clarify.